Cam and Danny. Okay, chapters 4 through 6 of The Road to Serfdom and some auxiliary reading are the subject for tonight. And these are some very interesting and important chapters of The Road to Serfdom. The inevitability of planning was an argument that advocates of central planning and a planned economy made for many decades. They thought that was their linchpin argument, that it's inevitable because of the inherent failures of the market. And they had all many different varieties of that argument that were made. And I can recall in the best selling economics textbook in the world from 1948 until the 1980s was Economics by Paul Samuelson. And in all those decades, Samuelson made the inevitability argument. He wrote very favorably about the Soviet Union, and even in the 1988 edition of his book, this is a Principles of Economics textbook, he predicted that by the early 2000s, the Soviet economy would be bigger than the U.S. economy. And he made the inevitability argument for generations that socialism or some sort of planning by the government in a centralized way was inevitable. And of course, that was all bunk, and he had a huge ache all over his face when socialism collapsed around the world. But nothing much happened to his reputation. That's the way the world is. And so the first argument that Hayek takes on here is what's known as the Marxian industrial concentration doctrine. Marx himself and a lot of Marxists made the argument for a long time that corporations would merge with one another so that the first thing that would happen would be every industry would be one big monopoly, just one firm, and then eventually the whole world would be run by one company. The mergers would be inevitable and never ending until there was just one giant company. And of course, the irony of that is that that is an exact and precise definition of socialism. Socialism wasn't run by one big company, but one big government. And so, you know, where we really did have that in the world in the 20th century was under socialism, not the free market. But the socialists argued the opposite, that no, it's a free market that's going to create one big monopoly. And a lot of people still believe in this, maybe not that one big corporation will eventually run the world economy, but industry by industry, because they're unaware of or ignorant of the economics of mergers, of what corporate mergers do and cannot do. And also, a lot of people confuse bigness with monopoly. You know, a big firm is not necessarily monopolistic. In fact, in a market economy, the only way to become really, really big as a corporation or as a company is to be really, really good at pleasing your customers. That's how all the great entrepreneurs in the 19th and early 20th century became very wealthy. That's how Bill Gates became the wealthiest man in the world, by persuading a lot of people to buy their products. And then, of course, in the marketplace, you have to use persuasion. That's in the free market. Under socialism, you can just tax people and force them to consume the things that you think they should consume according to your socialist central plan. But the market, of course, is very different. And so that's, you know, when you see a company that's big like McDonald's, well, it's usually because a lot of people like what they sell and are willing to spend a lot of money on it. I think they're getting a good deal. And this issue came up in the late 19th century when there were the first examples of large-scale corporate mergers in the American economy. And a lot of people became alarmed by this because it was a disruption of the normal state of affairs as far as economics goes. But the economics profession was almost unanimously in favor of allowing the mergers to take place, and also almost unanimously opposed to antitrust laws that would stand in the way of mergers or would slow down mergers. I've written a great deal on this myself. One article, a scholarly article of mine, is called The Origins of Antitrust, and the subtitle is An Interest Group Perspective. It's on the web somewhere, The Origins of Antitrust. There's a popularized version, sort of almost an interview-type version of it called The Truth About Sherman on Mises.org. and you can read about and some of my commentary there. But one of the things I did in this research that was published in the International Review of Law and Economics back in the 80s is that I showed that the first big wave of corporate mergers that happened in the United States for 20 years or longer led to lower costs, lower prices, better products, and more products. And so in other words, these were the hyper-competitive industries in America. And so you did not see consumers complaining at all. You did not see, and the economists of the day understood this. This is why they were almost unanimously opposed to the whole idea of antitrust regulation that would regulate mergers, because they saw the consequences of these mergers being efficiency and lower prices and the invention of new products that never existed before. John D. Rockefeller, for example, got rich by drastically dropping the price of refined kerosene and other petroleum derivatives, and he invented hundreds of additional products like Vaseline and all sorts of things that were byproducts of petroleum. And so that's what mergers did originally. And this has been sort of an ongoing argument among economists for decades, of the effects of mergers. And so when we go from the 1880s and 1890s in U.S. history, the economics profession was very friendly toward corporate mergers because they saw them producing almost uniformly good results, lower costs, lower prices, more products. But by the 1930s, the economists' theory of competition changed. The economic world didn't change. The theory of competition changed. And the fashionable theory of the day said that competition requires many firms. And so, of course, a corporate merger leads to fewer firms. And so all of a sudden, economists became suspicious of mergers, even though the same results were happening. Corporate mergers typically resulted in lower costs, lower prices, if they were successful. Because after all, if you're in an industry like John D. Rockefeller was, where even when his company was eventually broken up by the government in the year 1911, he still had over 300 competitors. If you merge with another company with the intention of raising your price, well, you will create a giant profit opportunity for everybody else who can just keep their price where it is and take all your customers away from you. And so, and that would be extraordinarily foolish. And one thing no one ever called John D. Rockefeller was a fool. And so, and you would be a fool to think that you could get away with raising your prices to monopolistic levels with 300 competitors, as John D. Rockefeller had. And so that has always been the general case. Not all mergers work out, of course, but the ones that are successful and lead to bigger companies that persist, that grow and survive, that's generally why they grow and survive. They figured out a way to create some sort of synergy that creates lower costs and lower prices. Okay, and so that's the first thing Hayek is addressing here in chapter 4. He talks about the Marxian industrial concentration doctrine, and what the Marxists said was that since every industry was going to become inevitably a monopoly, we need government planning. Government needs to take over all these industries, and that was the argument he was involved in at the day. Now, another thing that the planners forgot about or never learned was that there are limits to the growth of any corporation, and that corporations become bureaucratic once they reach a certain size. So they may be achieve economies of scale or lower costs, average cost of production as they become bigger and bigger because of mass production and the assembly line, the miracle of the assembly line. However, at a certain point, they become big and bureaucratic, and costs tend to go up. And so the marketplace imposes a limit on the size of business firms because they become inefficient. And becoming inefficient means their profits begin to go down. And that leads to another aspect of this that Hayek doesn't mention. But he doesn't mention corporate takeovers, but I will, because it's related to his initial point here. And there's probably the famous article or the famous citation on corporate takeovers is by Henry Manne. Last name is spelled M-A-N-N-E. And the name of the article is Mergers in the Market for Corporate Control. And it was in the Journal of Political Economy, I think around 1965, a very old article. Henry Manning gave a talk at the Mises Institute a couple of years ago on this and other topics. But the gist of his argument is that when you look at corporate takeovers, where one company or one group of investors takes over ownership of another company, what is usually going on is that the acquired company is thought to be operating less than efficiently. And in other words, there's a lot of slack, a lot of bureaucracy, a lot of inefficiency, and the people who are taking over the company see that. And they believe that they could take over the company, run it differently, and increase profits by reducing costs and making it more efficient. And so that's the basic motivation for the market for corporate control and corporate takeovers, because after all, in a globally competitive world, the idea that you could take over your competitor and corner the market is ridiculous on its face with so much competition, not only existing competition, but potential competition. Even if you did miraculously, for the first time in world history, take over an entire major industry, who's to stop newcomers from coming in? With all the billionaires in the world, and groups of billionaires, and hedge funds, who's to stop investors from anywhere in the world from competing with your monopoly profits? Nothing, not much. And so, so that's another aspect of this. Hayek doesn't explicitly mention the market for corporate control, but it's an important element of this. And so the reality is that government has always been the main source of monopoly, with some of protectionist tariffs, monopoly franchises for so-called natural monopolies and other things, occupational licensing regulation, and bans on advertising. Government has always been the most important impediment to competition. And so Hayek here is taking on this argument that says the opposite, that says competition is an impediment to competition. That's essentially the argument that the socialists made, not government planning. Therefore, we need government planning. But it's government planning, of course, that has always caused monopoly all throughout history. I could sit here for days giving examples. Two of the most famous examples in fairly recent American history were the Civil Aeronautics Board, which monopolized the airline industry until it was deregulated in the late 70s, and also the Interstate Commerce Commission, which monopolized the trucking industry in America until it was deregulated in the early 80s. And so a lot of regulatory agencies have been created for the purpose of being run for the benefit of the corporations that usually wanted those regulatory agencies to be established in the first place. So you get rid of regulation, you get rid of monopoly in these cases. And we did that in the U.S. by getting rid of the Interstate Commerce Commission regulation of trucking and the Civil Aeronautics Board regulation of airlines, although the airlines are still regulated in many ways. But so they were partially deregulated in the late 70s, and as a result, American consumers save literally many billions of dollars a year in airfares because prices are much lower. A second argument that Hayek gets into here is he goes back to his old theme of the use of knowledge in society, and he takes on the argument that a government planning of an economy is supposedly necessary because of the complicated nature of the modern economy, that markets can't handle all this complication. You need a group of experts in charge to plan the economy. And this is where Hayek answers by pointing out once again that the type of information that is most important in the operation of the economy is the information of time and place. It's the localized or decentralized information. It's not the scientific information of experts. Not that that is useless, but for the most part, the type of information that must be conveyed to make an economy work is the information in the minds of the millions of consumers and workers and managers and investors and everyone else who participates in an economy. And that information is very widely decentralized. And so he turns that argument on its head. He uses that fact, the fact that decentralized knowledge is essential for the operation of a rational economy, to say that the more complicated an economy comes through technology, for example, the more we must rely on markets and the less we must rely on planning, because government planners could not possibly possess in their minds all of the information of the millions of market participants. So that's the knowledge problem that Hayek is coming back to here in chapter 4. He also gives a rendition of the old infant industry argument, but in the context of technology, of new technology, at least as of the 1940s, which is when he was writing this book. And the argument that was being made was that, well, one of the industries in your country might invent a new technology that helps them produce some product, or a new product that did not exist before, at least in your country, or wasn't produced by anyone in your country. But we should have a protection from competition, though, because if all of this money has been invested in a new technology or a new product, it'll never get off the ground, it'll never fly, because there might be others around the world selling the same product or a similar product, and since they've been at it for a while, they might be better at it. Therefore, we need to block them out, to prohibit them from competing with us, so that we can have this product being developed at home. And Hayek points out that this is almost always a protectionist special pleading, that every business is saying we want a monopoly, we want a government-sanctioned monopoly, in other words. So this argument, the old socialist argument that we need to protect our own companies from competition, ignores the reality of how markets work. Because if you want a strong industry, from the perspective of society as a whole, or from consumers in particular, you want that industry to be subjected to competition, because it is competition that provides the incentive for innovation, to work hard, to cut costs, to improve quality of product, to provide good service to customers. It's not the isolation from competition, which is what the socialists were arguing for. It's competition. And so you don't want to have protectionism to encourage innovation. You want competition to encourage innovation. And of course, fast forwarding to today's world, just look at the computer market and how it is, how competition still leads to massive innovation. I see Cam found the Henry Manny article. That's great. That's an article on corporate mergers and the market for corporate control. And also might find my article, The Origins of Antitrust in the International Review of Law and Economics. I know it's on the web somewhere. The next argument that Hayek takes on is he's talking about compulsory standards that might be imposed by government. And this might be of a particular technology or even a particular product. And he's warning against this. The argument was being made that a lot of technologies in manufacturing might not work unless the government establishes one fixed standard for that technology and then forces everyone to adopt just that one technology so that everything fits right. In the computer world, you can imagine that. I can remember the early days of personal computers where all the different PCs were vastly different. The word processing packages that you had to buy were all different and were not compatible. And so it could be appealing to a lot of people to say that the government should impose product standards or standards for technology. But at the same time, what you're doing is you're locking in a particular type of technology that is preferred by government bureaucrats. And as a result, you would be destroying the incentive to invest in newer and better technologies. Because if you did, as a business person, invest in a newer or better technology, there could not be any profit in it if you would not be allowed to use that technology, if there's already a technology that is blocked in by the government. And of course, once the government creates a situation like that, where one particular technology becomes the standard, then everybody who profits from that technology, the companies, the employees of the companies, the contractors, the politicians in the districts where the companies are located, they will form a very powerful lobbying group to keep that technology in its monopoly status. So it will not be easy to change technology. Whereas in the free market, if a superior technology comes about, and if enough people learn about it, and decide that it is significantly superior to the old technology, they'll switch. You know, how many people do all of you know who have switched to Apple computer, for example, using a Mac? Sometimes if the technologies are kind of similar, but one has a minor edge over the other, it might not be worth it to spend all the time and effort learning the new technology. But at some point, it does, especially if it becomes significantly cheaper and better and makes your life easier. Sure, people will switch. So in the free market, you can switch fairly easily. But once government gets involved in standardizing technology, it literally takes an act of Congress and the president's signature to change the technology. And that's much more likely to happen, much less likely to happen than if you allow it to work on the free market. Okay. And so that's Hayek's argument that he's getting at here in sort of a roundabout way. And so another thing he touches on is kind of subtle in the way he just kind of briefly mentions it. But he makes the point that the planners were and are making the argument today, making the argument about technical or technological superiority being imposed by government. And I've heard this argument many times myself. When I used to teach MBA classes, I used to have a lot of software engineers in my classes, and it's just the mere mention of the word Microsoft or Bill Gates would get them all bothered and upset and angry, because all of them had some product or products for the companies they worked for that they were convinced were superior to the competing product that Microsoft was putting out. And they were very angry with the fact that Microsoft was selling a lot more of its product, which they were convinced was technologically inferior. And what I would always tell them is what Hayek says here, just in a couple of sentences, in his own unique way of saying it, is that what matters in a market economy, really, is what the consumers think about the technology. Now, you as an engineer may very well be absolutely 100% correct that technology X is better than technology Y. But in a marketplace, you have to convince or persuade the consumers that it is worth their bother and their time to give up the old technology and to invest whatever time and effort it takes to learn the new technology. And you might be superior, but how superior? If you're not very much more superior, it just might not be worth it to spend the time and effort learning a new computer or routine or whatever it might be. And so that's the point Hayek makes here, is that there's a difference between consumer sovereignty and the opinions of experts. Okay, and this is really what he's talking about here is an early version of what economists 30 years later started calling path dependence. This old socialist argument about the need for government-imposed technology was resurrected in the 1970s when they started talking about something called path dependence. And one of the first examples of this was a supposed market failure example. And it had to do with the typewriter or computer keyboard, and it's known as the QWERTY keyboard. Q-W-E-R-T-Y, that's the letters on your keyboard. And the story that was told by an economist named Paul Davidson in an academic journal was that there was another keyboard called the Dvorak keyboard. It's spelled D-V-O-R-A-K. It's a Czech name. He was an American, but he was of Czech heritage. Dvorak. Anyway, Paul Davidson, the economist from the University of Tennessee, wrote an article that was widely cited claiming that this is a good example of market failure, of where an inferior technology was locked in by the consumers, by the marketplace, and therefore government should have more of a role in planning for technology and in coercing us all to use the technology it wants us to use. But then there were another economist named Stan Liebowitz looked into this. Yeah, Stan Liebowitz and a co-author of his. And what they found was that the evidence or the proof that the Dvorak keyboard was superior to the QWERTY keyboard that we all use now was actually some studies done by a man named Dvorak when he was in the Navy, and he used the secretaries who worked for him to do these typing tests, and he claimed that his technology was superior, and he had a patent on that technology. And so that blew out of the water the whole idea that we should take seriously this this scientific proof, so-called, that the Dvorak keyboard was superior to the QWERTY keyboard. And then after that, Stan Liebowitz and his co-author actually did some studies, or paid people to do additional studies of computer keyboards, and they found that there wasn't much of a difference, after all, in efficiency between the two different configurations of the keys that existed there. And so that was sort of a resurrection of this idea, but it was based on a myth. It was a resurrection of this idea that government needs to impose on us a uniform technology in all in markets, or else the markets will fail. The second attempt they made was back when people still watched videos on these clunky old VCR machines, and the two types of videos were Betamax and VHS. And the market failure theorists argued that this was a market failure because Betamax was clearly superior, although most consumers were choosing VHS. And of course, that turned out to be false also. It came to be proven later that the VHS version was much superior. Oh yeah, and by the way, Stan Liebowitz's co-author is Steve Margolis, M-A-R-G-O-L-S. They co-authored a book on antitrust. Also, if you're interested in this whole topic of path dependence and antitrust regulation of the computer market, look up the book by Stan Liebowitz and Steve Margolis. The exact title escapes me right now, even though the book is probably laying on my floor on my bookshelf at the moment. I'm sure I have it. I know I have it somewhere. I only heard the title of the book is Winners, Losers, and Microsoft, by Stan Liebowitz and Steve Margolis. But in any event, Hayek was anticipating this whole line of debates back in the 1940s that became more of a debate in the 1980s and 90s in the economics profession. He then takes on planners. He then takes on social planners who he kind of makes fun of. And I have a few quotes here. He talks about... He says, for example, environmentalist planners, he claims, of his day, have a great exaggeration of the importance of the ends that they place foremost. For example, people who advocate the banning of billboards near highways and the banning of advertising along the side of highways by making the argument that it's unsightly, it's ugly, they don't like looking at billboards, they'd rather look at Mother Nature instead of looking at the billboards. Well, sure, you know, most of us like the outdoors and would rather look at nature than some ugly, rusted out sign. But what he's saying here is that people who are really dogmatic about planning everything, the highways, for example, and everything else, are really dogmatic about their priority. Their priority is looking at nature. But of course, there are other priorities in society. You know, why do people put billboards up that say something like hotel room, $20, clean shower, along the side of the road? Well, it's to compete with the bigger, more expensive hotel chains for travelers who are driving down the interstate. When they see a sign that says Motel 6, $20, Motel 6 can have a certain reputation. You know, you'll get a clean bed and a clean shower, and then you're on your way. Whereas if you have to stop at a more expensive hotel, you know, you will if you have no idea that a Motel 6 even exists. And so, in other words, advertising of that sort is a tool of competition, and that is another societal value. Other people in society value being able to compete for your business as a traveler on the interstate. And it's not just being able to look at the kudzu taking over the pine forest in Alabama that is the top priority of the world, after all. It's also advertising and competition in the free market. And so Hayek talks about this in order to make the point where he says this. He says, the most intolerant Those who are the most intolerant of the plans of others should never be given political power. Now, those people who are very dogmatic and intolerant of the plans of others, and who don't even recognize that the rest of us have our plans too, it's very dangerous to give these people political power, because they will use that power of threat, force, compulsion, imprisonment, or worse, to impose their values on the rest of us. So they act as though their values are the only ones that count. And so that's a warning that he gives in the context of planners here. And that's sort of the last thing I wanted to mention on chapter 4. And when Hayek gets into talking about planning and democracy, there's a great quote at the bottom of page 63 of my edition of The Road to Serfdom. It's worth repeating, I think. Where he says, the various kinds of collectivism, this is the first page of chapter 5, the various kinds of collectivism, communism, fascism, etc., differ among themselves in the nature of the goal toward which they want to direct the efforts of society. But they all differ from liberalism and individualism in wanting to organize the whole of society and all its resources for this unitary end, and in refusing to recognize autonomous spheres in which the ends of the individuals are supreme. In short, they are totalitarian in the true sense of this new word, which we have adopted to describe the unexpected but nevertheless inseparable manifestations of what in theory we call collectivism. So Hayek here is saying all collectivists are essentially totalitarians, because they want to impose, they want to use the coercive force of government to impose their will on everyone else. And whether they call themselves communists, fascists, socialists, liberals, democrats, progressives, any of their sort of unlimited array of words that they call themselves, environmentalists, and so forth, they're all totalitarians at heart, in that they want to boss other people around and tell them how to live. That's really their main end. And of course, that ignores the fact that we all have different ends. We all have different things that we want to achieve. And for a long, long time, one of the rhetorical tools of the totalitarian-minded has been words like the public interest or the common good. And Hayek talks about this. And of course, if you understand the real world of democracy, you understand that there can never be any such thing as the public interest or the common good with regard to any kind of legislation of any kind. Okay, and of course, in a society like the United States with some 300 million people, you know, for something to be in the common good, in the public interest, it has to be in everyone's interest, everyone's common interest, not 300 million and 999,000, everybody. And that's not going to happen, ever. And so it's dishonest to use this kind of language, the common good, but the totalitarian-minded among us have always used this in order to try to dupe people into thinking that their particular special interest is really in your interest. Arguments for protectionism are always made because they promote the public good or the common good. But of course they don't. They always end up promoting some sort of special interest at the expense of the interests of others in society, usually at the expense of the interests of a much larger number of people in the society, because after all, democratic politics is primarily special interest group politics. Hayek once commented in his other book, Law, Legislation, and Liberty, that what we really get out of democracy is not what the majority wants. What we get is a large collection of legislation that is essentially the result of log rolling in Congress, where a small minority that wants a special privilege for itself will say to other minority lobbying groups, we don't really care about your issue, but we will vote for and support your issue when the vote comes up, if in return you lobby for and support our issue when our issue comes up, even though you could care less about us. And so they cut a deal. And so as a result, what you get in democracy is a large collection of things that really are very narrow, minded pieces of legislation that benefit a very, very few at the expense of everybody else. And it's nothing at all like the sort of the high school version of democracy in civics classes where they teach about majority rule and the will of the majority. That's not what we get in a democracy for the most part. And Hayek made that point in his book, Law, Legislation, and Liberty, and he hints at it here. You can tell he's had this idea in his mind in the 1940s, and not long before he wrote that other book, which was in the 1970s, Law, Legislation, and Liberty. Volume 3 is the one it's a three-volume set, and I'm referring to volume 3 of that book. You also will not be fooled by the mythical language of the common good. If you understand basic political economy, basic public choice economics, my old professor, James Buchanan, coined the phrase way back in the 1940s of political externalities. In a democracy, we have all or none decision making. When we have presidential elections in the U.S., whoever gets elected is elected. You can't say, I voted for Ron Paul, therefore he's my president. If Barack Obama or Mitt Romney wins the election. And the same with when people vote on, at the local level, on school spending referenda. If the referenda wins and they decide to increase everyone's taxes to build more government schools, you don't have the ability to say, well, I voted no, therefore I'm not going to pay the higher tax. The government can take your house from you, or they can take the money out of your paycheck and force you to pay, and they will. And so government decision-making in a democracy is all or none in a democracy. Either we all get Barack Obama as president, or we get somebody else. We can't choose just who you voted for. Unlike the marketplace, of course, if I want to be a vegetarian and not spend a penny on bread, I can do so. If I want to drink Diet Coke instead of Diet Pepsi, I'm free to do so, and you're free to do the same. So in the marketplace, there's no such thing as all or none decision making, but in democracy it is. And so what that means is that there are always going to be a lot of people who are unhappy in a democracy, because no one politician could possibly satisfy everyone. In fact, Hayek also makes a point that is very typical of a Hayekian line of argument, where he says, in effect, that even if a politician, like a president or a prime minister, was a benevolent dictator, even if he was just an angel in his behavior, in his outlook on life, and was a dictator, he would still not be able to understand or know what everyone wants, because there's just too much knowledge out there. There are millions of people who all have individual preferences. So no human mind could possibly know what all those preferences were, even if that person was just an angel with a halo over his head who fully intended to do whatever he could to do good by every single person in the country. He could never do it. The world is too complex. We all have different preferences. And so even if you had a robot as president, a benevolent robot, it still wouldn't work. And of course, we don't have benevolent robots as presidents. We have real-life politicians. And so any type of legislation in a democracy will create what are called political externalities. Some people are harmed, some are not. For example, if the person who's elected president is the best middle-of-the-road candidate, who does appeal to the median voter, the average person who's sort of middle-of-the-road, who's not too much of a right-winger, not too much of a left-winger, well, all the left-wingers who want government to be bigger are unhappy because government is not bigger. All the people on the extreme right, according to the usual vernacular, who would like government to be much smaller, they will be unhappy too, because government is not going to be much smaller. It's going to be bigger according to the size that the middle-of-the-road candidate wants. And so the whole idea that there can be such a thing as the common good that is pursued by government planning is a myth, because there is no such thing as the common good. That's the argument Hayek is making here. Okay, and so in other words, so he uses that as an entree to his main argument that Hayek was a limited government guy, he was not an anarchist, and he says, well, you can make a kind of a case that as far as the common good goes for certain things, such as those things that are listed in Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution. And what would those things be? The national defense, the judicial system, protection of private property, and so forth. And you could probably get most people to agree that those are good things to have. But then beyond that, individuals should be left to their own sphere of decision-making. We should be allowed to live our lives and not be planned by any totalitarian planners. And there's a good quote of this point on page 66 of this chapter, where I'll quote some of it. Let's see. Here it is. It is at the very bottom. It is this recognition of the individual as the ultimate judge of his ends, the belief that as far as possible his own views ought to be govern his actions, that forms the essence of the individualist's position. And so we should give the individual as much latitude as possible to live his or her own life outside of the very few things that we give to government. But of course, that hasn't worked out that way, that once you give government an inch, it'll take 10,000 miles, is what history teaches us. And Hayek here is making the argument that you could probably get common agreement by a lot of people for the means, but not the ends. For example, you can get just about everybody to agree that democracy is better than dictatorship. But that doesn't mean that we can get any kind of agreement on what the democracy should be doing, what type of legislation it should be passing. Okay. And with regard to this point, he says this on page 69. He says, we can unfortunately not indefinitely extend the sphere of common action and still leave the individual free of his own sphere. Once the communal sector, the government sector, in which the state controls all the means, exceeds a certain proportion of the whole, the effects of its actions dominate the whole system. And he goes on to talk about the slippery slope of once you go past this minimal government area, that the government will inevitably create become more totalitarian. So Hayek was not naive in not knowing that limited government was a very tough thing to maintain. The government had this inevitable urge to grow way beyond what any constitution would limit it as. But he was sort of optimistic that through education and understanding and learning that at least a smaller society like the Austria where he grew up at could control the government. I doubt that he ever thought that a country with 300 million people and one giant central government could ever work in the way that the advocates of democracy would like it to work. Another argument that Hayek takes on here is the argument that has often been made that government planning could work. Well, yes, it's failed time and time again, but it could work as long as we take politics out of it. And during his time, there was sort of a worshiping of government bureaucracy and administrators. It was thought to be a worthy pursuit to become a government bureaucrat, even though the word bureaucrat has a bad reputation. And Murray Rothbard was excellent on this. If you read what Murray Rothbard had to say in Power and Market, especially his book Power and Market, on the idea of business-like government, for example. It's a complete myth, because no government could ever operate like a business, because no real business has everything capitalized by the taxpayers. It doesn't have the wages and the factory and the materials paid for by the taxpayers. It's a real free market competitive business. It's not given the government grant of monopoly like government agencies are and doing what they do. And of course, with government bailouts and things like that, we do have businesses operating more like government rather than government operating like businesses. Okay, when businesses fail and are bailed out, well, that's what government does for itself. Whenever it fails to educate children or to reduce poverty, it gives itself more of our money. And so what we have with interventionism is not government acting more like a business, but businesses becoming more like government. In that their failures are bailed out or socialized by the politicians. And on an important point also that Hayek makes here this is sort of a crescendo of this chapter, that is to say that government planning, whether it's called socialism or fascism or any other kind of collectivism, requires the imposition of a unitary plan on the society. That's what planning is about. It's a relatively small group of people in the government get together and work out some plan that they hope to impose on the whole of society. And he makes the case, well, this, of course, is inherently incompatible with democracy, because in the democracy, some people may object to the plan. They might want to have their own plan for education, for work, for how they want to run their lives. And you can't allow that, or else your plan for the whole society will not work if there can be dissenters. And so you can only have planning under a totalitarian society where people are forbidden from escaping from the plan. And that has been true, hasn't it, of society after society. And he sees through all the baloney that is put out there among the advocates of government planning by saying that government planning is really just the imposition of the plans of a small group of people to replace all the individual plans of a larger number of individuals. So it's the superseding of individual plans by plans of government bureaucrats and politicians. It's not the introduction of planning where there was no planning. It's changing in the structure of who is to do the planning. That's what government planning is. And he goes through also the situation of where inevitably government plans backfire, become counterproductive, make things worse rather than better, which they always do. And so what always happens is government politicians will never admit that their plans were mistaken, that they are responsible for these screw-ups and for the destruction of industry after industry that they supposedly planned. And so they will advocate some sort of economic dictator, and the people, desperate to return to prosperity, will be inclined to accept it in this type of regime where we have eradicated the ideas of liberalism and free markets and spontaneous order of markets. And once the people have forgotten all about that, they'll bite on the idea of an economic dictator. And this sort of led me to get a hold of this document that's on the web that I mentioned in the chat earlier, which is on Wikipedia. It's called List of U.S. Executive Branch Czars, C-Z-A-R, Czar, as in the Czar, the Russian Czar. And there's a table there on page one listing the number of Czar titles by president, beginning with Franklin Roosevelt. And Franklin Roosevelt was president for 12 years, and he had 11 Czars. And even up to Bill Clinton being president, there were only 8 Czars in the U.S. government. And then George W. Bush had 33, and then Barack Obama has 38 Czars. And you can find this list on the web yourself, but I'll read off some of the czars, or economic dictators. This is what Hayek was talking about. Economic dictators are sort of given these special jobs as presidential appointees who are not don't have to go through the process of being given permission by the U.S. Senate. They're sort of loose cannons who are given the authority of the President of the United States to dictate to different industries and different areas of society. Foreign aid czar, Afghanistan czar, AIDS czar, anti-poverty czar, Asian carp czar, car czar, several car czars, so auto worker czar, car czar, and so forth, bank bailout czar, bioethics czar, bird flu czar, birth control czar, border czar, budget czar, cleanup czar, copyright czar, communications czar, cybersecurity czar, democracy czar. That's an oxymoron, isn't it? Democracy czar, czar of the dictator, democracy. That's like democracy dictator, democracy czar. Domestic violence czar, doesn't that make you feel safe? Drug czar, several drugs, there are like 7 or 8 drug czars in charge of different areas of the war on drugs. E-commerce czar, energy czar, faith-based czar, food czar, that makes me feel good, AIDS czar, Great Lakes czar, the Great Lakes have their own czar, many health czars, housing czar, information czar, missile czar, Iran czar, Iran has its own czar, patronage czar, reading czar, reading. Shipping czar, science czar, regulatory czar, terrorism czar, urban affairs czar, and so forth. And so here's old Hayek in the 1940s making the argument that when interventionism fails, politicians are inclined to adopt some sort of economic dictator. Well, we've got at least 38 of them in the United States already in all these czars. So it is kind of bizarre to look up that table. You can find it. Cam might be able to look it up and put it on a website. It's from Wikipedia. That's all of his czars. Okay. One final concluding point that Hayek makes in his chapter on democracy has a great concluding point on page 78 at the bottom. Where he says, it is at least conceivable that under the government of a very homogeneous and doctrinaire majority, democratic government might be as oppressive as the worst dictatorship. Our point, however, is not that dictatorship must inevitably extirpate freedom, but rather that planning leads to dictatorship because dictatorship is the most effective instrument of coercion and the enforcement of ideals, and as such, essential, if the central planning on a large scale is to be possible. So keep that in mind when you're thinking about all these czars, that it's the most dictatorship, economic dictatorship is the most effective instrument of coercion, and the enforcement of ideals is essential if central planning is to be possible. Okay. And that is definitely relevant to what we see in Asian American society today and a lot of other countries as well. Now, finally, Hayek's comments on the rule of law. And the ancient idea of the rule of law, the way Hayek always looked at it, and he's written several books on the rule of law, is that the rules of society, the laws, ought to be clearly defined and made available in advance to everyone, so that everyone knows what's legal and what's illegal, and you can guide your behavior accordingly. And now, of course, that doesn't mean that all rule of law societies are good rule of law societies. If we had a rule that said, in order to avoid overpopulation, the government will murder 1 million people each year at random. Well, that's a rule. We all know it in advance, and so we can adjust our behavior accordingly. Well, no, that's not the sort of thing we had in mind. It's, you know, what is a crime? What is it not? Theft, murder, rape, pillage, all the traditional things that are forbidden by the Ten Commandments. That's what he has in mind, not just any old rule. But what he's thinking about is that all the worst tyrannies of the world always did away with the rule of law because the government always wanted to use the law as a way of punishing political critics, political opponents, and keeping itself in power with ad hoc laws that would punish its critics on the spot. And you don't need to have a dictatorship, though, in order to have the abolition of the rule of law. Hayek makes the case that government planning of an economy destroys the rule of law itself because the thing about the rule of law is that these rules should always apply equally to everyone. If it's illegal to steal a car, it should be true of the President of the United States as well as the poorest person in the United States. But what planning does, by definition, is to treat many different groups of people differently. If the government imposes price controls on the ministry, for example, well, those who are lucky enough to purchase the product before it becomes in short supply, because shortages are always caused by price controls, they'll be better off, but the people who sell the product are worse off, and the people who have to go without altogether because price controls, price ceilings always cause shortages, they're worse off. And so the more planning you get involved in, the more inequitable redistributions of income and wealth you create. And that's exactly the opposite of the intent of the rule of law. The intent of the rule of law is always that laws apply equally to everyone and they're well known in advance. And of course, in planning, nothing is known well known in advance. We live by whatever the government dictates at the moment. If you bought yourself a Starbucks franchise in New York City, for example, because you thought you could make money selling 16-ounce frozen drinks, and then all of a sudden the mayor of New York City comes out and says, no more 16-ounce frozen drinks, people are too fat, which he did a couple of weeks ago, well, that'll affect you in a negative way, won't it? After you invested the $500,000 or whatever it would take to buy a Starbucks franchise in Manhattan. And so that's just one minor example of what Hayek is talking about here, about how government planning creates all sorts of unequal and unjust redistributions of income, the opposite of the rule of law. And he makes a nice analogy here. He calls the idea of the rule of law, it's sort of like establishing the rules of the road, whereas planning would be ordering everybody where to go, telling everybody where they must go. Whereas the rules of the road, you know, drive on the right side of the road, that would be akin to the rule of law idea. And so the more the state plans, the more government plans our lives, the more difficult it is for individuals to plan. In fact, I would go further than Hayek does there and say that the more the state or the more the government plans our lives, the less incentive we have to even bother to plan our lives. Why make plans if you know that your plan will not be possible to execute if you're going to have to comply with the government's plan? If I would like to live in a house with a white picket fence around the yard, but the government zoning authority tells me, sorry, we cannot. You cannot paint your fence white. It must be gray or blue or green. Well, then, why even bother thinking of planning how I want my yard to look if the government won't allow me to do that? And so, so government planning does destroy individual planning. It's sort of called the crowding out effect of government planning in economic circles. In fact, there's a whole book written by political scientist Charles Murray entitled In Pursuit, and the subtitle is colon, the subtitle is Of Happiness and Good Government, and there are several very good chapters of this book, In Pursuit, by Charles Murray, the famous author of Losing Ground. His more famous book was Losing Ground. There are several chapters in it about how government crowds out individual initiative, about how welfare gives people incentive to ignore the poor people in their own neighborhood. Social Security gives people incentive to spend less time worrying about their own retirement or the retirement of their parents and grandparents. Government-run schools give people less incentive to take care of the education of their own children. So it crowds out the individual planning there. And of course, once the government ruins old age insurance and government schooling and these other things, then we're left in a situation of where we haven't planned and we're stuck and we need to catch up. And I think that's about the last point I want to make. I've been talking on here for an hour, and so I think I'll quit there and I'll look, as usual, I'll look at the Q&A and the chat to see if you have some questions, and feel free to add some questions here. Let's see, Sam is asking about the czars. These are executive branch creations. And the reason why they don't abide by the Constitution is that nobody in Washington abides by the Constitution anymore. You can quote the Constitution, you can memorize it, you can carry it in your pocket, like the people at the Cato Institute encourage people to do. But it's pretty much useless. You might as well carry toilet paper in your pocket these days. Politicians in Washington pay no attention. How many more examples would we need to understand this? What was it last week that Obama declared that all illegal aliens under the age of 30 are hereby legal residents. Well, you could read the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, is a section that gives legislative powers. All the powers that the legislature, the Congress has under the Constitution are listed there in Article 1, Section 8, and one of the powers is naturalization, to determine who becomes a citizen. There's nothing in the Constitution that gives the president the ability to just announce citizenship policy, but he did, and the bureaucracy is enforcing it, and that's what we'll have. And so, and this is nothing new. The government has not really enforced the Constitution for a long, long time. It uses the Constitution alternatively to provide a legalistic sounding rubber stamp on just about whatever it wants to do. For example, if you read Andrew Napolitano's book, The Constitution in Exile, he'll tell you that not one federal law, not one, was ruled unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court from 1937 to 1995. And since then, only one or two pieces of legislation. And so essentially, the Supreme Court's job is to rubber stamp whatever the government wants to do. And even if they claim Obamacare is unconstitutional, we're still going to get Obamacare unless there's a massive secession movement in America. They'll figure out a way to rewrite the law to make it satisfying to the Supreme Court eventually. So when I see people writing questions like this saying, what about Article 2, Section 2? Well, what about it? The government hasn't paid attention to Article 2, 3, 5, 10, 12 for many decades now. And both parties like this, because both, after all, I mentioned that Bush had 33 czars and Obama has 38. They like being dictator, playing dictator when they're in power. If Floyd Lilly wants to know what was Hayek's take on the legal form of the corporation, you should probably read Law, Legislation, and Liberty on that. I think legal form of, well, of course, a corporation is just a collection of individuals who band together, form an alliance to cooperate and produce goods and services for sale to other people in society. That's what a corporation is. It's the same thing as what is called a cartel. That's why there's really no difference between a cartel and a corporation. And because they come together as a legal, in a legal contractual way, I don't think anybody should have any problem with that. You know, when I enter an employment contract, I agree to do a certain type of work, and you agree to give me a certain amount of pay and remuneration for my work. I don't see why any libertarian would have a problem with a contract of that sort. And you don't even have to have government courts to talk to me contracts like that. Let's see if we have some other questions here. Let's see, I'll look at the Q&A then. Try to anyway. There's a weatherization czar. Let's see. Yeah, I'm still looking for questions here. AJ Scherer asked, do I think voting should be harder and not easier? Yes, I do. I think at this stage, people should not vote. I have an article on LouRockwell.com that I wrote years ago called Be Patriotic, Don't Vote. And the argument I make is that since almost everything government does is unconstitutional anyway, it is just one big massive transfer or scheme or plunder scheme, that when you vote, you are lending credence to the regime, because the regime always says we are simply carrying out the will of the people. That's what gives them their power. But if only 2% of the people voted, then they could never say that again. It would delegitimize the regime. And so the patriotic thing to do would be don't vote. The unpatriotic thing to do is to support the illegitimate, unconstitutional regime of gangsters that essentially runs the government nowadays from both the two parties. And so I would argue that you shouldn't vote at all, not just that we should make it harder to vote, but it's your moral duty to not vote, in my opinion. Malcolm Arnold has a question. As capital, I'm not a Marxist, so I don't use language like capital and labor. I guess you mean that the business gets bigger, larger companies will look to create a state mechanism. Well, they don't need to get bigger. They have a lot of small businesses that can band together. You can have 10 small businesses who all collect money to bribe politicians with something that would be to their benefit, that would screw the public. I mentioned last week, that happens all the time. Every time Walmart shows up in a community, and why is Walmart so successful? Well, it sells the same stuff that you can buy at the mall or at unionized grocery stores 20, 30, 40% cheaper. That's why Walmart is so successful. It's been doing that for decades now. And so all of the mom-and-pop monopoly stores that exist in these various communities that are charging higher prices than Walmart is charging, they can all band together. You might get 10 or 20 of them, each put in a couple thousand dollars to bribe the city council or the state government or both to find some arcane regulation that could be imposed to get Walmart to not exist in their community, and to deprive the people of lower prices and better variety of products. So you don't need to be a big business to lobby the state. The real problem is the power of the state. If the state has had to have legitimate power in planning the economy, well, yeah, businesses of all sizes will try to use and abuse the powers of the state to plunder their customers and the rest of society. This wasn't always as true as it is today, because property rights were thought to be more sacrosanct 150 years ago, for example. And even the government courts in the United States recognized this. And a book I would recommend to tell this story is The Birth of a Transfer Society by Terry Anderson. Terry Anderson and P.J. Hill. The Birth of a Transfer Society. They go through Supreme Court cases, American Supreme Court cases, that time and again invalidated price control laws. For example, because a price control law violates the sanctity of contract, and there's a contract clause in the U.S. Constitution, or governments are not, state governments, you know, no state can pass a law abridging contracts, as long as the contract does not involve force or fraud. And so, but that eventually changed, because what changed first was the sanctity of property rights in the minds of the public. So there was an ideological crusade by the socialists of the day in the late 19th, early 20th centuries to water down the support for property rights. And so it became acceptable for government to impose regulations like price control regulations that were supposedly in the public interest, the common interest. And so it's not the existence of a business per se that creates this. It's the ideology of collectivism that is the evil here. That's where this idea comes from, that government has some sort of right to interfere with private property and to plan the economy. So the answer to this is to cut back as much as possible on the government power to control. And let's not go overboard in how big business, by the way, controls government. If it was so controlling, then there never would have been an antitrust lawsuit against Bill Gates and Microsoft. Microsoft was hounded by the federal government for 8 years worth of investigations, and then they brought a lawsuit that lasted years and years. And then nothing much happened of it. Same thing happened to IBM in the 1970s. Beginning of the 1960s, I believe. They were hounded for, 15 years, even though they were one of the biggest corporations in the world. And then the government finally, after all this investigating and the lawsuit that was filed and was litigated for, I think, 13 years, the government just decided it didn't have a case after all and said, oh, okay, forget about it. And so, just being a big corporation doesn't necessarily mean you have become big or successful in controlling the government. Sometimes you are and sometimes you aren't. A lot of times one big corporation will use its influence with government to harm other big corporations that it competes with. And that's the economic reality of the world, I think. Let's see, I hope there's more questions here that I can find any. Let's see, Bill Anderson, in terms of reading the use of knowledge in society, he says he thinks it's like the article was to communicate and elaborate what Mises wrote 25 years earlier. I don't know what his motivation might have been, but I have an article in the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics a couple of issues ago called A Note on the Canard, C-A-N-A-R-D, of Asymmetric Information as a Source of Market Failure. And one of the things I point out in there is that Hayek and Mises both wrote about how asymmetric information, that is, different information in the minds of consumers versus producers, for example, is really why markets exist. I don't have the same information about how to raise cattle and butcher them and dress them into beef so that I can have steaks as grocery stores and farmers do. The farmers specialize in that. I specialize in something else. They have specialized information in how to be a farmer. I have different specialized information. I make money doing what I do so that I can go to the grocery store and buy a steak. I don't need to have asymmetric information or the same information as the people who sell me my food, the people who build my house, the people who sell me my car. That's their job. Let them do it. Mises, of course, wrote about this when he wrote about the International Division of Labor in many places in Human Action. And it's really essentially the same idea that Hayek talked about. And the point I make about this is that Mises was writing solidly in the machine age, where the division of labor was the rhetoric, division of labor in society, specialization. Well, Hayek anticipated the information age, and he essentially makes the same point, but he calls it the division of knowledge instead of division of labor. So now that we're in the information age, where brain has taken over brawn as the primary ingredient in economic success, then the division of knowledge in society makes more sense rhetorically, I think, than the division of labor, in which is Mises was writing about in his day. So I think Bill Anderson makes a point there. I recognize that similarity too, but I don't know what his motivation might have been to make Austrian economics more appealing to the mainstream or not. Who can tell? Let's see. George Smith, is anarcho-capitalism the only rational option of social organization? Well, we can debate this endlessly, but You know, Hayek and Mises were limited government libertarians, as are most people who call themselves libertarians. Ron Paul is a limited government libertarian. He's the most famous politician who espouses libertarian views. however, if you look at more and more of the scholarship, there's more and more scholarship on the courts and how rotten the American legal system has become, on the military, and how the military really is an offensive, not a defensive organization, makes enemies, not friends, for Americans for the most part, and therefore makes our life more dangerous. The police in America have become sort of corrupt and totalitarian. And so there is a literature in libertarian circles about alternatives, the private police, private military, private court systems. I mentioned some of the authors last class, such as Bruce Benson on the law and on the police, Hans Hermann Hoppe on national defense, the myth of national defense is one of his books. And so that's the sort of thing that we can talk about intellectually. But as students always want to know, you know, what kind of solution to this problem can be imposed tomorrow. Well, of course, that never happens. And the first step to a solution that makes life better is to understanding how we got to where we are, and to understanding feasible alternatives that preserve freedom in a voluntary society, too, at the same time. And also, when we're thinking of this whole issue of, anarcho-capitalism or no government, don't compare that type of situation to some sort of perfectionist ideal of government that you're taught in ninth grade civics class. Compare it to the real ugly world of government, where in the 20th century, governments around the world murdered hundreds of millions of their own people, not in wars, but simply the murder of dissenters. You know, read Death by Government by R.J. Rummel, for example, if you're not familiar with that, or look at his website, Death by Government. And so compare the real world actual governments that we've had to the alternatives of private police force, private security guards, our private military, and so forth. Don't compare that sort of anarcho-capitalist world to some sort of nirvana utopia. That's ridiculous. And it's useless to think that way. So I can't answer that question then, of what's most desirable. You have to figure it out for yourself. Here's a question by Sam Chick. He's talking about Hayek's statement that a democracy can be just as totalitarian as socialism can. And the question is, how does this line of reasoning stand when the fact that the limit, however well-reasoned and reconciled with natural law, are in fact attained by some level of consent, democratically derived, and therefore arbitrary? It depends on whether you not believe that government is a government of consent. The last time any group of Americans, for example, banded together and said, we no longer consent to being governed by Washington, D.C., we believe, they said, in Thomas Jefferson's dictum in the Declaration of Independence, that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. And therefore, since we no longer consent to being governed by Washington, D.C., we're out of here. The last time a group of Americans of any significant size did that was in 1860 and 1861, when the people of the southern states seceded from the Union. And the U.S. government responded by murdering about 350,000 of them and burning entire cities like Richmond and Atlanta to the ground. Plundering tens of millions of dollars of private property, murdering tens of thousands of civilians, women and children included, and that pretty much cured Americans of the notion that government, their government, was a government of consent. So I would argue with anyone who claims that we have a government of consent. And I think the only reason the government allows us to have free speech is that they know it doesn't really matter what we say. anymore. They don't want to talk, although they do occasionally crack down on it, and they do their best. They threaten to ban the internet, in emergency situations and things like that. And so I would argue with the proposition that we have a government by consent or a voluntary government. There's never been anything voluntary about government. I never signed off on the U.S. Constitution. If you want to look at that as our consent, I never did. That was 1789. What did I have to do with that? Nothing. And no one alive today ever had anything to do with that. So there was never any vehicle for anyone to consent to being governed by the government in Washington, D.C., as far as Americans are concerned. And it was David Hume, by the way, who made the argument that just because a sailor does not commit suicide does not mean that he has consented to being drafted in the Navy. And so just because we do not commit suicide by, say, taking up arms against the government or something like that and being wiped out doesn't mean we consent. Okay, we consent and we know, but we haven't seceded yet because Americans especially know what happened the last time a group of Americans tried to test this theory that America had a government by consent. And by the way, the latest scholarship on the American Civil War death is 750,000. It used to be for decades, since the early 1900s, 620,000. But it's pretty much become accepted now by historians that it was more like 750,000, which would probably put the death toll of Southerners in about the 450,000 range if you include civilians, not just war deaths, but civilians. And so that's my answer. If you hear a weird noise, it's a cat meowing in the house. It'll stop in a minute. Kind of a weird cat. He'll run out of breath in a minute. Let's see. I'm looking for more questions here. Eric is asking, Hayek talked about the importance of ideas. If Ron Paul or someone of a similar limited government perspective, you have a good reason to vote. Why has there been a third party breakthrough? Well, the two parties have the whole system rigged. They got the whole media to announce that Rick Santorum won the Iowa caucuses, for example. But we now know today that the reason for these caucuses and primaries was delegates to the Republican National Convention. That's what this is all about. Well, as of today, June 20th, Ron Paul has 23 out of 28 delegates from Iowa. So he won Iowa overwhelmingly, but the Republican Party declared Rick Santorum the winner in Iowa. And so the whole system is rigged. If you wanted to run for Congress as a third-party candidate, they have the rules rigged, so you have to get 10,000 or 100,000 signatures, depending on what state you're running for. Whereas if you're a Republican or a Democrat, you need nothing. And so so it's almost impossible for a third-party candidate to run. And even if Ron Paul was elected president, the entire Washington establishment, the entire media, the entire university system, with very minor exceptions, would all work diligently day in and day out to sabotage everything he tried to do. And so I wouldn't expect to see any great surge of freedom, even if Ron Paul was miraculously elected president. Once you've abandoned the ideas of freedom and have embraced the ideas of collectivism and socialism and planning, well, you've got an entrenched government bureaucracy where there are many, many people who have self-interest in perpetuating that system, which is why I think the only solution is peaceful secession, which I think is still possible for Americans. Let's see if that's a more question. There's a question from Malcolm Arnold about the cost of government on the economy. Has everyone ever calculated that? Well, there's no way to quantify so much of what government does to the economy as far as that goes. We know it's big. The Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., its website is CEI.org, publishes something every year called 10,000 Commandments. And it's an examination of all the government regulations, and they make sort of ballpark estimates of the cost of compliance and so forth. So there have been people who are at least friendly to the Austrian school who have attempted to make these kinds of cost estimates. And I guess it's a useful thing for somebody to do, but so many of the costs are subjective that most Austrian economists would say it's probably not worth the trouble to publish these things. I don't know the origins of adjustable rate loans. Maybe someone else in the list here does, but I can't answer that question about adjustable rate loans. And a cat howls every once in a while. She's 17 and a half years old. Every once in a while she starts howling like a dog. I read this. David Graves says, since by 1928, Germany's GDP was more than about 50% of government spending. Is not smoke and mirrors to describe Hitler's actions as abolishing democracy in Germany, when already all of life would have been controlled and planned 5 years prior to Hitler's crowning, in order to distract from the fact that the U.S. regime is fascist. Yeah, we are essentially fascist. Fascism meant we allow private property, but it is strictly regulated, controlled, and regimented according to some dictates handed down by the state, and that certainly describes a lot of most of the American economy these days. And so another aspect of fascism was bailouts. Once the German government essentially de facto took over all these industries through regulations and controls, it was responsible for the outcome, for the performance of those industries. And so when the industries failed, they bailed them out. So a massive bailouts was ostensibly private businesses was a characteristic of German and Italian fascism. And that's essentially what the direction we have moved into in a very big way in the U.S. Sam wants to know the best book from my perspective on the war between the states. I call it The War to Prevent Southern Independence. I would read The Real Lincoln by me, and I would read Lincoln Unmasked by me. But The Real Lincoln would be the first one. Question about by Johann Hawker. I don't know what Hayek would think about this David Graeber's theory in Debt to the First 5,000 Years. I haven't read the book either. But the question is, what is my historical view of debt as an instrument of power? Well, as an economist, one of the things debt does is create what economists call a fiscal illusion. That if the government can defer the cost of government in the future, it makes people perceive the cost of government being lower, and therefore the people are more likely to go along with or acquiesce in an expansion of government powers if they think it's going to cost them much less than it actually will. So if the government can issue 30-year bonds, people will see the tax debt as being lower because the debt is passed on to the future. But realistically, though, if the government is going to spend an additional $10 billion, let's say, this year, it does commandeer $10 billion worth of resources, and it allocates those resources. That's what the debt is for. So So in the terms of the use of real resources, there is no deferring to the future. The government sucks up those resources now, and as a result, the private sector cannot have those resources. But the actual tax bill comes, that part of it, the tax bill part of it comes due way off into the future if the government issues 20 or 30 year bonds, let's say. And so as a result, a lot of people can be fooled in thinking the tax bill is much lower than it actually would be if they paid with taxes. Okay, good. Murphy has already written a review of this book, so read Bob Murphy's review. I'll go back to the chat here if I can. Maybe I will. I'm not sure where I am here. Bob Murphy is very good on these issues, so I would recommend any review of that book that Bob Murphy wrote. I'm looking through the Q&A here. Question. Let's see, there's a question that says, in Omnipotent Government, the book Omnipotent Government, Mises writes, labor unions are likely to be hostile to capital export because they're eager to raise as far as possible the domestic marginal productivity of labor. To understand what he's talking about here, if a business increases the amount of capital invested, let's say a businessman invests in newer equipment, newer technology, well, that makes the labor who he hires more productive if they can work with better tools, better machines. And that is said to increase the marginal productivity of labor. So if capitalists invest more in technology and equipment and machinery, capital, here in the United States, then that will increase the marginal productivity of labor. It makes labor more valuable. Now, the second step to understanding this is that in a competitive market, employers compete with each other for the best workers, and so in order to compete for workers, they have to pay these suddenly more productive workers more if they want to keep them. Because they become productive not because of anything they did. They're not any better educated, they're not stronger, they're not smarter or anything. They have better tools paid for by their employer. So they're essentially freeloaders off the risk-taking and investments of their employers, and they benefit from it financially. And what Mises is saying here is that some labor unions anyway might understand this. And so they don't want capital to be exported overseas. They want it to be kept here because they supposedly understand the link between capital investment and machinery and equipment, and which leads to higher productivity of labor, which ultimately eventually leads to higher productivity or higher wages. I don't think labor unions have ever been that smart, so I would disagree with Mises that they actually think that. Maybe he was aware of some unionists of his day who understood this. And I do know I have met some unionists who have studied economics and they do understand these things, so it is possible. Malcolm Arnold wants to know, was Mises a statist? No, you shouldn't call Mises a statist. He was a limited government conservative on the issue of political philosophy. He was not an anarcho-capitalist. He believed in limited government for certain purposes. He would have approved of the U.S. Constitution's declaration of the legitimate functions of Congress in Article 1, Section 8, I think. But he was the biggest anti-statist of his day. Freest markets in the world currently, there are these indexes of economic freedom. They're all imperfect. One of them is published by the Fraser Institute in Canada. That's F-R-A-S-E-R. And they purport to measure economic freedom around the world. And they usually put Singapore very high. Hong Kong is usually pretty high. up there also. The U.S. is not nearly as high as it was, but Singapore is usually way up there. Let's see if I have some more questions here. I'll go back to the chat then. If Bob Trumbo wants to know if the EU crashes, what's the next step? Well, that's why we try to spread these ideas of freedom as far and wide as we can, because it all depends on whether or not the people of Europe, there are enough people in Europe who understand these ideas and understand that it's a good thing that the EU crashes. The EU is a central planning agency. It attempts to centrally plan not just one country, but all of Europe. It's a horrible idea. And so the crash, that's a good thing, but Europeans are very good at shooting themselves in the foot, so I wouldn't be surprised if they tried to adopt something even worse than the EU, but they would have a battle on their hands. I know there are a lot of free market thinkers all over Europe now thanks to generations of intellectual efforts started by people like von Mises and Hayek many, many years ago. And so they would have a fight on their hands. So I can't predict what would happen, but the abolition of the EU would be great. David Graves, false history. There's a long history of court historians, people who rewrite history to support the state. I would recommend Murray Rothbard's article, The Anatomy of the State. It's online, where he talks about the indispensable role of intellectuals as court historians in doing a lot of things, including rewriting history to make the state seem heroic and useful and magnanimous and brilliant, and to critique the civil society and the free enterprise system. Anatomy of the State by Murray Rothbard would be a good essay to answer that question. Questions about all kind of things sort of detached from the road to serfdom here. There's an old argument about the gold standard. There's not enough gold in the world. There's not enough gold in the world to continue inflating the economy the way we've been inflating. It's not a bad thing that there's a limitation on the amount of gold in the world. That's the whole point of the gold standard, is to limit the ability of governments to grow beyond the reasonable means whereby they can do things that, as Hayek would say, could command reasonably general agreement by people that governments are okay doing these things. People who say there's not enough gold, well, they assume the governments all need to be doing at least what they're doing today, and then the 10% growth forever. But no, that's the whole idea of a gold standard, is to place a limitation, and so I don't really see this is the problem, that there's not, we don't have an unlimited and infinite supply of gold in the world. If you have any questions in the Q&A here, I'll go back there. Well, let's see them there. I guess we're getting near the end of the road here. I guess we're sort of running out of gas, and it's about 8:15 anyway, so I guess that's about it for tonight. We've talked enough about serfdom and roads to serfdom. And feel free to email me if you have any burning questions. And I did promise to make up a quiz after the second class for anyone who wants a grade. And so I can do that. I'll send it on to Danny Sanchez, and he and Cam and others can be the administrators. And so thanks again for participating in the class. I hope you learned something. Hope you continue to learn something, and have a good night.